I didn't mean to exclude the fact that he will be setting up systems. David brought this to my attention. It sounded like I was just saying that he's going to judge individuals. No, that's not true. He will certainly set up systems, just like Moses had systems. He will definitely be setting up the Sanhedrin and everything with the lower courts and the whole system of courts that the Torah mentions about how to set them up in Deuteronomy. But he will also judge individuals. My point was that he will always be judging individuals, even though he cannot really judge that many individuals because there's not enough time. But the fact is that the Torah believes that the greatest impression will be created by the fact that people will know that there is a judgment going on by this individual that is completely just. And this is something which affects humanity, which affects people. So that's what I showed from the verse in Kings, in 1 Kings, with King Solomon, where it mentions that when they heard that case, that one case with the two harlots, when they heard that case, it left an impression, it made an impression all over Israel. And you see that's true today, because you see people look up, when people think of justice, the greatest man, the most prominent man in the land, plays a big role. That's why you'll see that the Torah's psychology is correct with all the to-do that's going on today about the Clintons. Why do they have, what's this, all this to-do? The answer is that what he does is extremely important it reflects the entire country. If he's corrupt, then the country's corrupt. And if he's honest, then it's a sign that the country is honest. People in that position do not realize that they influence as the Torah says, they influence more through their deeds than they do through their direct machinery of influence. You see, and that's the mistake that people make. People put all their stock in their political campaigns and all their and all the methods that they have, the political methods and mechanics. And all those mechanics and all that politics really does very little. The greatest impression is, after all, a single deed that the person did. If it's good, and if it's honest, and if it's intelligent, then it's impressive. And if it's corrupt, then not only is that person frowned upon, but it really is a sign that there's something wrong with the whole country. And that's why you see people sense this just by taking a look what's going on with the Clintons. It's like Clinton, I think, made a joke. He said, everybody's concerned more about my tax return than their own. It's a joke, but it's true. And it's true because of the fact that that is the way man's psyche is constructed. That if the most prominent individual in the country is corrupt, there's something wrong with the entire system. And the King Messiah will, through the fact that people know that he is spending his time with a poor man, a person that is very low class. He doesn't have any importance no societal importance. But nevertheless, this great man is spending time worrying about his case that might be $5 or $30 or $100, but he will be treated justly to the nth degree, as if it was the most important case in the country. When people see that, then they see that true justice exists. And this will impress the entire world. That's what I meant. I did not mean to exclude the fact that there will certainly be the systems will have to be working, because these two cases are only models, but they really can't be enough to instill law and order in the whole country. Law and order in the Torah system, and by the way, it's true in the Torah system, in the Jewish system, as well as in the Ben Noach system. That you have two, the Torah system works in a strange way. You have two systems of law and order. One is the Sanhedrin, or the court, and the Ben Noach system, and two is the king. And I told you the difference is that the court has to go according to the halacha, whereas the king goes according to his own intelligence and his own investigations and his own knowledge, and he's not restricted by the halacha. There's a reason why there are two systems. You see, there have to be two systems. One reflects the system of the commandments, and that's the Sanhedrin. But the other one is a concept of sovereignty, And you must have both, because there has to be a leeway. In other words, you can't be always restricted by the halacha. And the halacha, you see, and this is what we mention all the time, that the Torah approaches man in two ways. One way is through rigid laws, and if you just read the five books of Moses, you'll see the content of strict, rigid law. But then the other way is through the ideas of perfection, which is really the goal of the rigid laws. But without the rigid system, man cannot be affected. And a similar thing is true on the societal level. You have the Sanhedrin, which reflects the rigid system of law, the rigid law that God gave. And then you have the king, which has a lot of leeway. You see, a lot of leeway, but this is necessary. A virtuous king is necessary because you have to fill in the gaps which often are caused to exist by the fact that you have the rigid system. And you can't do away with the rigid system because all the concepts in the rigid system are beautiful and the ideals are really something which which shows God's wisdom and the beauty of God's knowledge. So that we must have. But then again, for the practical, you must have the king's sovereignty where he can impose, he can move, he's free to move and free to fill in the gaps. So the two systems are really complementary. And they exist both in the halacha of the Ben Israel as well as in the Ben Noach, as we cited from Nachmanides when we did the case of Judah and Tamar. So, okay, that I hope that clears up that point. The second point I wish to make was that I mentioned last week, I believe I mentioned that the Torah goes from the halachic system, then you go to philosophy, and ultimately to God. So there's it's like a step ladder. From the knowledge of Torah, you go to the knowledge of God, and from the knowledge of science as well. But I just wish to emphasize, I do not mean to imply that if a person takes a science course, that he is that this individual is approaching God. It's not true. Because the only science that approaches God is if the knowledge of the universe is studied in a very specific way. Now, not everyone is capable of doing that. I quoted some great people like Sir Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein or a Rabbi was also a great... As a matter of fact, Rabbi was a great physicist, world-famous physicist, and when he was in Columbia University... And when a student would come over to Rabbi and would say, I want to do this and this is such an experiment, Rabbi would say, why did you pick that experiment? Will that teach you about God? So the person who has a straight mind, a straight intellect, can go from the laws of the universe to God. But it's a rare kind of an individual, and the science has to be viewed in a certain manner. So I don't want to give a false kind of impression that anyone that takes courses in a university is actually, according to the Torah, is doing a virtuous deed. He's studying God's universe. It's only valuable if the way that he studies it leads to God. But in our universities today, that is not the case. As a matter of fact, you find... some of the most atheistic people that teach these courses, and they don't have the secret of how to reach God through knowledge. So such knowledge really is valueless in the eyes of Torah. If a person, for instance, a biologist, spends his life studying a cell, studying the functions of the cell, and this is not a ladder for him through which he could reach and see God, then really we don't value such knowledge. But there are people who have the ability to study God's universe, like the prophet says, and from the heavens declare the glory of God. You have to have the personality that has that philosophical and scientific approach, that kind of a framework. There are people that have it, and Gene Lavers is a person that I would mention. I would mention his name as an individual who has that sensitivity. And when he studies DNA, he's involved in a righteous deed, a mitzvah, because he has that sensitivity where he could see that this, the way this DNA is organized, there is a master designer, and he could see the fingerprints of the creator in it. That kind of science is the science that Torah is interested in. That Torah says perfects man. But if that is not the framework, then there's no perfection, and it's valueless. There's one thing I will say, and that is that the study of Torah itself is much more conducive. Even if a person is not capable of making that bridge, of going from the scientific world to the metaphysical world, the bridge between those two, and to approach God, if a person is not capable of doing that, he might not be able to do it in science. But in Torah, he will find it is much easier. Because the subject matter of Torah itself is one that brings a person to God, because it analyzes a person's way of life, his relationship to God, and the subject matter itself is one that the analysis and involvement in that subject matter leads a person to God quicker and in a much more direct way than the study of the universe. But of course, Torah, I'm speaking about Torah in the ultimate sense, and we are all very far from that level. But nevertheless, you know, one of the philosophical principles of Torah is that even though we may be on a low level, we're supposed to study the highest level. And it shouldn't disturb us. We shouldn't think, well, we're not on that level. That's not proper. What we should think is that studying the highest level is something that's going to impress us. It leaves something with us. We may not even know what it is. We may not even sense it. But studying the great personalities and characters of the Torah is something that it leaves us with something which raises us to a higher level. So that's why we speak of Torah in the ultimate sense. Now, Torah in the ultimate sense is really the appreciation of God, of God's knowledge through all of his handiwork, through the Torah which he created, through the universe, and all knowledge leads to God. We say that the entire world is filled with his glory. What does that mean, that when the prophet says the entire world is filled with his glory? What it means to say is that any area that you touch, if you analyze it, you'll see the wisdom, and through that wisdom you see the glory of God. It means from the smallest stone, if a person would analyze the smallest bit of matter, has infinite wisdom that man has not even begun to exhaust. And the same is true with the entire universe. So wherever a person goes, God's wisdom is implanted in the universe. And that's what we mean by, that's what the prophet means, that the entire world is filled with his glory. It means, glory means that someone is glorifying. It means that when man goes to any part of the universe, any area whatsoever, he can see God's infinite wisdom. And that means that he glorifies God. Okay, so those are the two points that I wish to make with regard to what we did last week. Now I would like to continue with the study of the Book of Esther, and I know that we interrupted it, but you see, that's the way Torah is. In Torah, we're not very formal in Torah. Torah is a free kind of subject. We go from one subject to the other; it doesn't matter. The main thing is the ideas, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. We don't have any specific order. If it's this book, that book, we just follow the ideas, and we don't have to feel, you know, that we have a very strict kind of what would I say? We don't have a strict curriculum. That's what I'm looking for. Okay. Now, the next point that I'm taking up is. We did the personality of Ahasuerus, and we did the personality of Haman. Now we're going to do with the third personality that's involved in the Book of Esther, and that is the personality of Esther herself. So we said that based upon the verse at the end of Esther, where it speaks about the fact that the Israelites accepted upon themselves the days of Purim, and we said there was a reference there to the fact that that there was an analysis, an analytical point, and that was in Esther 9, verse 26. So it says, and what did they see about this, and what happened to them? Which is a cryptic verse. But what it means is, what did they see means it was an analysis of the four personalities. What did these four personalities see, and what happened to them? So it was really it's really a study. That verse tells us what the whole study of the Megillah is, the Book of Esther, that is. This, of course, we have through tradition, because when they wrote the Book of Esther, so they also gave the insight into the book and how to uncover it. And that's the verse that opens up the entire book. That verse says that the main thing of Purim was, of the holiday of Festival of Purim, was to analyze what did these people see and what happened to them. What was their view of life and what was their lot in life? So we mentioned Ahasuerus and we mentioned Haman, and now let's see what they say about Esther. About Esther, they say the following. What did Esther see? What was her uniqueness, in other words, her vision, that she invited Haman to the feast, to her party? Okay? Now let's, the rabbis just give a little touch of insight. Then they expect you to finish it off on your own. So what we have to do is we have to analyze what Esther did. Now if you remember, I think we left this with this point last week, that first Esther invited Haman and the king to the feast, and this made, of course, this made Haman extremely happy. And at the feast, so the king said, and this is in Esther 5, verse 6, the king said to Esther, at the feast of wine, what is your request? And up to half of the kingdom, and it will be done. And I think I mentioned that that was one of the fine points. The rabbis mentioned that Ahasuerus had several fine points in his character. And this here again, you see that he was a generous. He was saying to her, basically, we rule the kingdom together, half and half. Okay. So now it says as follows. It says that her request was to the king. She said that the king and Haman should come to the feast that I'm going to make to them tomorrow. That's verse 8. And then tomorrow I will do as the king requests. Okay? Now, that sounds kind of absurd to us. Because what does she do the next time? So then the next feast, as you know, what happened was that the king asks again, what do you want? And that's in Esther 7, verse 2. And then Esther comes out with the fact that she was sold together with her people to destroy, and then the king Ahasuerus says to Esther, who is it that did this horrible deed? And Esther, of course, turns and says, it is this man Haman. And that really was the finale for Haman. But the question is, why did she do it in that manner? Why didn't she present this immediately at the first party? Why did she say that party will come tomorrow to a party? It's a very strange kind of thing. What was in her mind when she did that? Okay. So, and this is what the rabbis point to, that this was the pivotal point of the analysis of the acts of Esther. So what we say is as follows. We're saying is as follows. That Esther really had great psychological insight. And you see, this is the difference between the Torah religion and between other religions. Other religions, they rely on God. The main thing is to be pious and to rely on God. Torah maintains that you have to be an actor. You must do. You must use your knowledge, your wisdom, your intelligence, and you must act. God, of course, God assists the righteous. There's no question about it. But this world was made for us to do and to act, not to sit back and to simply pray to God. Of course, prayer is an effective measure, an effective means, and we employ that also, because that is an effective means. But we don't just pray, we believe that one must do. Now, Esther, what did Esther see? And when we say do, we don't just mean to act, but we mean to think primarily. What the Torah tries to teach a person is that they must realize the importance of their mind that God gave them, and not to use the mind is a terrible, terrible sin. And to use the mind is a great mitzvah. So what Esther did was like this. You see, she was very intelligent. What she did was she recognized all along that there was some kind of a friction going on here between Ahasuerus and between Haman. And even on the surface, Haman seemed to be very successful. And the king even commanded everyone, they must, as we read last week, they must bow down to Haman whenever he passes through the courtyard. Okay, fine. But that's the surface. That's people who just look at surface material would be impressed. But Esther knew that while the king is being so generous and so favorable to Haman, underneath, he's brewing some kind of discontent is brewing, and Haman actually is building up a great debt. Now, let's take a look. What would be the debt that Haman was building up with regard to the king? One thing we could see right away if we use the wisdom and the insight of the rabbis, and that is, if you remember, when the queen Vashti, when she was disobedient to the king, so the king asked the wise men. That was in Esther 1:13. So he asked the wise men, the men who have knowledge of the times, means astronomy, the astronomers. He knew that apparently he was not a stupid person, and he knew that astronomers and mathematicians, that they're intelligent people, and he would approach them. And actually, the Sanhedrin were the ones that are referred to in this verse, because they were always into astronomy because of the calendar and the new moon. They had to be very well versed in astronomy. So he approached the wise men of Israel, the Sanhedrin. And it says, again, I repeat, it says that this was one of his virtues, that he would always ask. He wouldn't just, if there was a problem, he wouldn't just rush to judgment. He'd ask advisors. He didn't have that kind of a sick ego where he felt that he has to have the answer. He was intelligent, and he listened to people and took advice. Now, the rabbis declined, the scholars of the Sanhedrin. They declined because they said, as I said, listen, we can't win. Because if we say to kill her, he's going to be angry at her after he sobers up. And if we say not to do anything to her, then he's going to be angry because the law was violated, then his ego is going to be hurt. So either way, we can't win. So they told him, they said, we don't do this kind of thing anymore. We lost our temple, and we don't have any death penalty, and we just don't know how to analyze that kind of an area. They bowed out. But there was someone who ran right in there to give advice. Who was it? So if you take a look at Esther 1, verse 16, it says, Memuchan, his name is. Memuchan said before the king and before the princes. And then he gives a philosophy that Vashti, the queen, didn't just sin against the king, but actually it's a violation against all the princes and against all the nations because of the fact that now women will be able to be disrespectful to their husbands, and this will cause a whole wave of feminism, and this is not good for the kingdom because the men have to maintain control. So he saw it as a universal principle here as being undermined, and he rushed in with his answer. As a matter of fact, the rabbis say that the word in Hebrew Memuchan really was Haman. But why do they call him Memuchan? Because names in the Torah, if you study the Bible, you see that many times people have different names. And the reason is because each name signifies, the names are used in two ways. Not just like today, you're born, they call you Jim or Joe, whatever. It's just a reference. But in biblical times, the names were because of personality traits. So a person could be, different people could call it different persons by different names because of certain traits that they saw in the person. So this is one of those cases where the name Memuchan was used for Haman. Why? Because Memuchan means he's ready. He is ready. And ready is really the word that is appropriate right here. Because while the intelligent men of the Sanhedrin backed out, seeing that this is a troubled kind of situation, it's not going to work, he jumped right in. Why? Because his ego was ready to be the advisor. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the things that the Talmud states. The Talmud states that from this we see a Talmudic a dictum, which is that a fool jumps to the front. A Talmudic aphorism. A fool jumps always to the front. He always runs to be the head. And this is stated about Haman. because of his crazy ego, he right away wanted to be the great advisor and jumped right in and gave this advice. Now, of course, the advice didn't backfire immediately, but you can be sure that the king, after he lost his wife, and later he was upset when he sobered up, he remembered who gave him that advice. Of course, he couldn't wrong Haman, because Haman was doing it in good faith, insofar as he saw. But nevertheless, it was some kind of a, you might say, like descriptively, a kind of a subconscious dissatisfaction with Haman, which was one thing that always was in Ahasuerus, in the king's heart, which was not good. By the way, it's an interesting thing. You see, the way Haman thought over there in universal principles, and I want to show you that the wicked person thinks in universals. He thought universally. He said that this was not only a crime against the king, it was a crime against the whole community, the whole country, and all the provinces of the king. And again, you see the same kind of thinking that Haman used, the exact same kind of thing, when Mordechai refused to bow down before him. It says that it was. This is in Esther 3, verse 5 and 6, where it says, verse 6, it says, "And it became too little in his eyes to stretch out his hand against Mordechai alone, because they told him about the nation of Mordechai. And Haman wished to destroy all the Jews that were in the kingdom of Ahasuerus." He was an intelligent fellow. He said, "One second, this man, why does this man refuse to bow down? It's because these people refuse to idolize another human being." Well, if that's the kind of philosophy they have, we have to remove this kind of people from our kingdom. Because they will never accept, they're not into hero worship of a human. That is not tolerable in my philosophy. So again, you see, a wicked person is not a stupid person. Hitler was not stupid. He thought in universal terms. But he was motivated by wickedness, the same thing as Haman, exact same manner as Haman. Motivated by his egomania and by setting himself up as an object of worship. That is really the illness of Amalek. Now, that's why Amalek refuses to worship God, because the worship of God makes a person feel very humble. When he sees God's infinite knowledge and he knows that in his short lifetime he can't even scratch the surface, he feels like nothing. He feels like Abraham said, "And I am just dust and earth, dust and ashes." So that's why Amalek can't tolerate the philosophy of Torah. So, again, getting back to this point, this was one debt that Haman really built up with the king. Another thing, something else, of course, was the fact that Haman insisted on, and this is my conjecture, but I would assume it would be true from a psychological standpoint, that you notice that the king commanded that everyone bow down to Haman. Now, that's something which I would say probably that idea was initiated by Haman, that he made it clear to the king that this is what he wants. And the king, wishing to show him favor, bestowed this honor upon him. He thought he's a loyal subject. He is he's a great leader. So he gave him the favor. Everyone should bow down to Haman. But you could be sure that this was something which, while he did it, again, there was an underlying debt, a little bit of dissatisfaction, or perhaps even more than a little bit, dissatisfaction was brewing in his mind. Because a human being works that way. See, with a human being, the important thing in psychology is not the overt actions, but what's going on beneath the surface of the personality. A person can be very friendly to you, but if inside he's brewing, the internal emotions are more important than the external manifestations. You see, now Esther was extremely brilliant.
Rabbi,
yes.
We got to change tapes.
Okay. So, So now we're getting. Now, what did Esther do? Now, see, this requires insight. She, being a deep thinker and knowing, being a student of Torah. If you're a student of Torah, you have to be a psychologist, because the Torah is a combination, the most unbelievable combination of philosophy and psychology. So, she, being a student of Torah, being a very wise woman, she knew that things are brewing over here between the two. So her move was really, when you think about it, an ingenious move. She didn't wish to disclose at the first party anything. she just said, I want another party tomorrow. Now, this was more powerful than anything she could have said. Why? Because this caused Ahasuerus to get very suspicious. It aroused his curiosity. What could she want tomorrow that she can't tell me today? And it started his mind started going. And you see how true it was, and how accurate her assessment was, because if you take a look, it says, just a second, let me just get the, it's after that incident, which was in Esther 5, so where she made the request to meet the next day, so you'll take a look at 6, and that night, the sleep of the king was disturbed, you see. Why was it disturbed that night? That was precisely because Esther got his mind going. She said, tomorrow I'll meet with you, I'll tell you, I can't tell you today. What could be here? What could be going on here? Now, when he started to think, when a king starts thinking, a lot of things go through his mind, mainly with regard to his own security. What is the greatest danger that a despot has? The greatest danger that he has is that he's going to be overthrown. And he doesn't know what's going on behind his back. And his whole life is really involved in trying to protect himself to make sure that he's not overthrown, not killed. So when Esther said that she wants to meet with Haman, he started to think, what's going on? What's happening? What is going on? And is there something between them? Maybe something's going on between them. Maybe there's some kind of a conspiracy here. Maybe they want to get together. Maybe they want to kill me. Various things went through his mind. The important thing is not the particular things that went through his mind, but this general suspicion, this attitude of suspicion, which Esther engendered in him by inviting him the next day to another party. That was the beautiful, ingenious move that Esther made that really saved the day, because this was really the turning point. Now, you have to realize when the king became suspicious and started to think something's awry here, why did she come in? After all, the king knew that she came into the courtyard and she even endangered her life. Something important. And then this party, and she can't say what it is, and tomorrow, he started to think. And you could be sure he started to think about the fact that he lost his first wife because of Haman. You could be sure he started to think about the fact that Haman is asking him that everyone should bow down to him, and he went along with that. And also, you can be sure about something else, that when Haman went to the king and he made this whole, he told the king that we must destroy the Jews. He got onto this whole project of destroying the Jewish people, and in the process, he said that how are we going to destroy them? We will have the populace will be armed, and the populace will destroy the Jews. Now, the arming of the populace is a very dangerous thing. After all, when people are armed, they could turn against the Jews, but they could also turn against Ahasuerus. So here Ahasuerus suddenly looks in the middle of the night, he's in a state of unrest, and he realizes that Haman isn't just interested in killing Jews. What he's doing is he's starting a whole movement here. And the Jew is the scapegoat. He wants that's part of it. He's giving people an outlet for their aggression. And by the way, the Talmud says that in those days, serious economic depression in the time of Ahasuerus. And Haman blamed the Jewish people for the economic depression. He says they have too many holidays. They're always having holidays. So it was really, Ahasuerus started to realize you don't just destroy Jews. What you do is he's setting himself up as a leader. That's what Haman's point is. And he's making himself great, so he's becoming a great leader for these people. These people are behind him, and he's got the people, he's got them armed, they're bowing down to him, and what does Ahasuerus see? Suddenly he sees that he's in great jeopardy, that this man can take all, he became a big leader, and now this man can simply take all these people and just overthrow the kingdom. And the thought in the back of his mind started to irritate him. So what did he do? If you take a look, he was an intelligent person, as I said before. A person is not a king if he's a fool. So what did he do? He said, bring forth the Book of Remembrances, the history. And he says, have it, and it was read before the king. Okay? So the rabbis tell us again that Achashverosh had a very good trait, and that was that whenever anyone did him a favor, he always wrote it down. Never forgot a favor. Of course, that's the wise thing for a king to do. So what he started to think was, if he's in danger, what does a king rely on? How does a king know when a conspiracy is taking place? There's only one way he knows. He finds out from his loyal subjects. If he doesn't have loyal subjects, he's finished. The conspiracy, they will be done behind his back, and he'll be overthrown, be killed. So he realized this, and he said, read through the history. What happened in the history of my kingdom? I want to know everyone that did a favor for me. And, of course, as you know, they read through the story with Mordechai. And Mordechai, two people wanted to kill the king, and Mordechai went to Esther. Esther told the king, and they were put to death. So then the king said, just a minute, he says, now Mordechai, was Mordechai rewarded for this? What reward was given to the man? After all, he started to sense his own vulnerability and his weakness, and he realized the only way to support himself, to remove himself from, to make himself invulnerable to as much as possible, is to make sure that people know that if you're loyal to the king, that you're rewarded. This is the most influential way of getting people to be loyal. And that is to show people that when people are loyal, they're rewarded. Now he says, just a second, Mordechai saved my life. People know of this. Did I demonstrate? Did I make a demonstration and show people that someone who is loyal is greatly rewarded, especially someone who saved the king's life? So now here is where we see, at this point, he mentions, at that point, the ones who are with him, his servant said to him, nope, we didn't do, nothing was done with this man. We did nothing. Obviously, he was upset about that. And here's where we see divine providence. So we see divine providence in the next verse. In the next verse, the king says, who was in the courtyard? And it says that Haman came to the courtyard to tell the king to hang Mordechai on the tree which he had prepared for him. Now take a look at Esther 5:14, and you'll see an interesting thing. Again, reading between the lines of the text of the Tanakh. Here we see verse 14. What does it say? It says Zeresh, his wife. When Haman came home, he was happy, but he still was extremely upset because he saw Mordechai didn't bow down to him and didn't budge, and this was something which repulsed him. Now in verse 14, he came home and he told his wife everything, all the wonderful things, and he said how upset he is. What happens in verse 14? His wife and all his friends said to him, let them make a high tree, 50 cubits high, and in the morning go to the king and tell the king, and you should hang Mordechai on this tree. And now you can go tomorrow to the party very happy. Okay? And the thing was very good in the eyes of Haman. And apparently, he immediately set up the gallows. Now, the interesting thing is, over here, Esther 6, verse 4, we find the discrepancy here. Because it says, the king says, who's in the courtyard? And Haman came to the courtyard, the outer courtyard, to tell the king to hang Mordechai on the tree which he had prepared for him. What's wrong? Well, where's the discrepancy? There's a serious discrepancy here, if you read between the lines. The discrepancy is very simple. His wife said, tomorrow go to the king and tell him to hang Mordechai on the tree. But you see, Haman didn't wait. Haman went in the middle of the night. Why? Because the hatred was so great that he did something. The Talmud tells us that there are two emotions that cause a person to act irrationally. One is hatred and one is love. Either one can cause a person to act irrationally. So over here, the hatred of Haman was so great that the rational thing would be to wait for the morning. Where are you running in the middle of the night? First of all, it was late at night, obviously, because the king happened to be up because he was mentally disturbed, but he was psychologically disturbed. But Haman didn't know this. Nevertheless, Haman was going to the king with a chance that maybe he's up because he was so eager, so anxious to make sure to remove this Mordechai, which the very existence of Mordechai is the most disturbing thing, the intolerable in Haman's life. So he rushes into the king's chamber. Now what happens? And this is where divine providence moves in. What happens is when the servants said to the king that Haman is standing in the courtyard, so the king says, okay, let him come in. And then and as soon as Haman walked in, the moment he walked in, the king asked him this question. Very funny. Look at this carefully. Verse 6. He says, the king says, what do we do with a person who finds favor in the with the king? And now we see the most unusual statement that we ever see, practically. I don't know of any other case like this in the Tanakh, where you have a description of what's going on in somebody's mind. It says, Haman says in his heart, to whom would the king want to give honor more than me? Now, how did the writer know that this was what was going on in his mind? But the answer is very simple. The answer is because of the fact that the answer that Haman gave was nonsensical. You see, he said like this. Haman said to the king, he says, the man that the king likes, and he goes through, he should bring the horse and the garments that he wore, etc., etc. Everything sounds right. There's only one thing. There's only one thing lacking here. Haman rationally should have asked immediately, well, who is the person? Who is it? You notice he never asked it. Why? Because his egomania had reached such a peak that the assumption was that it's him. And that is really the mark of egomania. Egomania is such that the person always assumes the entire world is revolving around them. They can't see any reality outside of themselves. And this was something which, of course, Haman, his personality, was completely egomania. So he assumed immediately that it was him. Now, here we have a delicate interplay. So you have Haman assuming that it's him, but now what does the king say? The king's response, the king also senses this, by the way. Do you know that one of the principles of psychology of Torah is that people have ways of communicating outside of the actual speech and even facial expression, but there's like an underlying communication that exists between people. There are ways of communicating without even speaking. Just like an unconscious transference of feeling. A very subtle kind of a communication. And here, of course, you can be sure that the king, who had in his mind, he was building up this hatred and this suspicion, I should say, this extreme suspicion about Haman, and now suddenly Haman walks in and Haman doesn't ask any questions and says immediately, that person should be honored to the highest degree. Don't you think the king noticed that? Why didn't he ask who it is? The king sensed that it's because this man is so far gone that he can only think about himself. And you could see in the king's response that that is the case. Because what did the king say? It says, the king said to Haman, he says, go quickly, take the garments and the horse, just like you said, and do so to Mordechai the Jew, who sits in the gate of the king. Do not omit anything from that which you have stated. Now, don't you see in that verse 10, don't you see the king's anger being expressed here? Because, first of all, why did I say to Mordechai the Jew? He knows. I mean, these people knew each other for years. Mordechai and Haman were the most prominent men in Ahasuerus's court. Why Mordechai the Jew? What he was expressing was what was going on in his mind before. Just a moment he was thinking, is Haman really want to destroy the Jews because he wants to do something good for me, like he said, because he's concerned that the Jews don't keep my laws? Or is he really involved in his own program, setting himself up at the head of this program as the philosopher of the country, dictating universal principles, first about the men and women, and now about which nations are fit to live and which nations are not fit to live, and arming the populace? Is it not possible that he has something else in mind? And that's why he said to Haman, he said, you go. First of all, why did the prime minister, why did he insist that Haman went? This was really the greatest degradation for Haman to do this. He was, after all, he's the prime minister. But the king was really expressing his anger, which came about through what went on in his mind that evening. And that's why he said, you do this to Mordechai the Jew, implying that how could you want to destroy an entire nation. But what about a man like Mordechai that saved my life? If you're really concerned about me, how could you destroy such a person? Don't you realize when you destroy such a man, what you're telling the people is that a person who saves the king's life is going to be destroyed? So at this point, the king became more than suspicious about Haman. He became convinced that Haman really is not operating in the interests of the king, but rather there's good reason to believe that Haman is operating on his own behalf and doesn't care about the king at all. And the proof is that Mordechai went unrecognized after he saved the king's life. So in order, when the king actually gave that command to Haman, he was retracting all the greatness that he gave him, and he was putting him in his place, and he was already having doubts about the whole program. We don't know what would have happened at that point if he would have gone through with destroying the Jews, but certainly he was against the idea. He realized that it's irrational to destroy this the entire people. After all, what about a good man that actually saved the king's life? This would be ridiculous not to honor such a person. So that's why he sort of put him, he said, if you're interested in my behalf, then you go out right now and you show the greatest honor to this Mordechai the Jew, because you maintain it's for me. Well, this is the right thing to do for me. Then go ahead and do it. And he sort of threw it in his face, so to speak, and insisted that he carry out something which was degrading to Haman, and which if he wouldn't do, of course, then he would know for certain that Haman was really interested in his own benefit and in building himself up and actually involved in a conspiracy to overtake the kingdom. Okay, so now we see, when we analyze this, we see the interplay, how the Torah describes the interplay of personalities, the psychology that was going on, and Esther's ingenious maneuver, where she sensed that and she knew exactly what to do to more than saying anything to the king, to place him in a state of suspicion. So that his own mind, let him stew in his own juices, so to speak, and bring about the situation that would create a hostility between Ahasuerus, the king, and the prime minister Haman. And then we see the intervention of God by the fact that here's the one-to-one point where we see the intervention of God, where Haman walked in precisely at the right moment. And this is really the whole philosophy of Torah. The philosophy of Torah is that God assists man. God wants man, as I said before, to be a doer, to be intelligent, to think, to learn, to study Torah, and to learn and to study life and understand people and understand life deeply on a deep level. Then act with that knowledge, and then God helps. And then God moves in and he creates the situation so that the person can achieve success. And that's exactly what happened here. That's why the Megillah is such an important book, because we see this area, that chapter 6, is the crucial turning point. And that scene where Haman walks in is precisely where we see, people always say, how does God work? And that's the purpose of the Megillah, to give us some insight about how God works. God works after man has exhausted all his intelligence, his energies, his thoughts. And as you remember, the people repented, and Esther fasted for 3 days, and they all repented, and they prayed to God. After they returned to God, and after they're functioning properly, and they use their intelligence in working out the proper scheme, then God adds the finishing touches, and creates a situation that results in success. So that's really this chapter 6 is the crucial chapter in the book of Esther. Now, of course, what happens next is, as you know, what happens next is when Haman already came the second day, So then you see, and when you read the Book of Esther on the surface, it sounds like a tale, because it sounds like, well, suddenly the Esther says to the king that he wants to destroy my nation, and I'm a member of that nation. And suddenly the king says, "Who is this? Who is this person I wish to do this?" He says, "Haman," and then the king instructs Haman to be killed. Yeah, but the but actually, when you read, as we said before, between the lines, you see the build-up, the unbelievable build-up and turning of events that took place before. Now you see, the second party, everything was set, because the king was convinced already that Haman is not interested in his benefit. Destroying the Jews is a campaign which makes him a philosophical propaganda leader, and he's getting the people on his side, because you see, when someone saved my life, he didn't do anything for me. So now the king already, all his suspicions already reached a climax, and he has turned already in his mind against Haman. Now when Esther comes to the party, all she needed was the finishing blow, and the entire wrath of the king was unleashed. So that's why it says that, if you'll notice, and Esther, of course, was very places her request in a very intelligent way. She says like this. She says in chapter 7, verse 4, she says, "Because I and my nation are sold to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be utterly annihilated." Now she goes on, she says, "And if we had been sold for slaves, male slaves or female servants, then I would have kept quiet, because it wouldn't be worthy of disturbing the king for that." Now, that was, when she put that in, of course, that was another blow. Because what she was saying was, to the king, was, if Haman really is interested in your welfare, why didn't he at least enslave the Jews? After all, you have all that manpower. So that manpower could have been used for your enrichment, for your wealth. But you see here that he was not seeking your benefit. And so by placing that, by the way she phrased her statement, she placed another idea in the king's mind, another proof that Haman was not really interested in the king's welfare. Otherwise, he would have enslaved them. Why should you overlook manpower, after all? And the people, the people were, after all, everybody's physically capable of working. So that was the point that was another subtle point that she actually inserted in her request. So then, of course, the stage was set, and then the anger of the king was completely, the wrath of the king was completely unleashed. Now, you see, there was another thing that happened here. The final scene was, it says, when the king left, and of course Haman was frightened, and the king was angry, it says, and he left. He went from one place to another place, and then it says that the king returned from the Garden of Bison, and he went back to the party house, and where the party was, and what did he see? He sees Haman is falling on the bed which Esther was on. And what does the king say? Take a look at what he says. He says, "Do you intend to capture the queen with me in the house?" What does that statement mean? What does that mean, actually? So, historically, whenever someone would dethrone the king, what they would do is they would take the queen. The taking of the queen was the sign of the assumption of power and the removal of the former king and the replacement by the new king, taking the queen. Now, what happened was like this, that Haman in his fear and in his haste made a serious error. He should have begged the queen, but he simply lost himself and he fell on the bed. Now, when the king walked back in and he saw that sight brought to mind exactly what he had been fearing all this time. So that scene, that's why he says, "Do you intend to capture the queen with me in the house?" In other words, are you trying to take over the throne? There again we see the divine intervention. That the king left the room, Haman falls on the bed, and then he walks in and he sees the scene, which reminds him of the of his greatest fear, the most horrific vision that he could have, is right there before his eye. And that, of course, sealed Haman's fate. So we see again the interplay between psychology and between God's assistance, God's actions. Now, then as a matter of fact, if you read the end of the chapter, it reads very beautifully where it says that Harvona, one of the servants of the king, said to the king, also the tree which Haman made for Mordechai, who spoke well of the king, stands in the house of Haman at a height of 50 cubits. And the king said, hang him on it. Now, this is not just a little story. Again, each verse you have to look into. What Harvona said to the king, that's why Harvona, if you look at what his words, he said, this Mordechai spoke well for the king. He saved his life with his speech. And Haman wanted to have him hung. That, do you realize what that would cause in the kingdom? That would mean if a person saves a king's life, he could be hung. He could be hung. Not only is there no compensation, not only is there no reward, but he could suffer the greatest penalty, death. Now, is this something which promotes loyalty in subjects when they see that? Absolutely not. So, therefore, that's why the king said, you hang him on that tree to demonstrate that anyone that tries to take away the reward from a person who did good for the king will himself be hung. And through that demonstration, the king showed his subjects, on the contrary, that in this kingdom, those who are loyal to the king are rewarded, and not only that, if anyone wants to take away from their reward, they will be severely punished. And that was Harvona's. That was how Harvona came in, and the king's that's the explanation of the king's response. Okay.
All right, we got 1 minute.
1 minute left.
Yeah, and what I'd like to do is before you go any further, and we don't have time to do it on this tape, next week. I would like to go back and deal specifically with chapter 6 and verse 13,
okay.
Verse 10 of chapter 6, in relation to what the wife, Zareth, what they prophesied, what she said against him, and I'd like to deal with that on next week's tape.
Excellent.
Okay?
Let's stop here and we'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.